yourselves.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
As an owner of an auto repair shop, I am not your typical member of Congress. While I'm working hard to keep our community safe, I also hear other things from you.
Marie, is that a normal car sound? Come on.
That's what it does, and then it jumps.
No matter your concerns, I'm working with everyone to find solutions that are right for Southwest Washington.
That is Marie Perez, or Marie Glusenkamp Perez, if you prefer, a member of the Democrat Party, a member of the United States Congress, and she allegedly represents not only 800,000 people in Southwest Washington, at least allegedly she represents me, although I think she doesn't exactly do a good job. Now, she's running for re-election, and we have known since the beginning that Marie Perez is a phony from the get-go. Only there's a brand new story out, and it's very well documented. It's by a young lady named Jessica Costuco, and she wrote for the Washington Free Beacon. She said things about member of Congress Marie Glusenkamp Perez that I had never heard before, and it shows even more so that you've got somebody in the United States Congress representing on the Washington State Congressional delegation a real phony. Let me dig into the details of that in just a moment, and I'll tell you all the background, because it is hilarious. I mean, I understand that if I start talking about phonies in politics, we could be talking till the cows came home, because there are lots and lots of phonies in politics. But this young lady has been a phony way, way, way back. And her backstory, well, as it's described in the headline for this story, she is definitely cosplaying as a poor person. In other words, she makes up this mythology that somehow, I was just a poor child from a working class family, and then I went to this school, Reed College. Well, let me dig into that in just a moment. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we put naysayers right to the head of the line. We only ask that you make it clear, what do you disagree with? Something you've heard on the show, something I've said. I don't mind if you take issue with that, as long as you explain what it is that we disagree about. And then allow me to ask a couple of questions in aid of an objection. So if you want to dial in, it's 866-439-5277. You can send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our poll on X today: should a sitting president be able to profit off America's 250th birthday? Now, what am I talking about? Well, Donald Trump has a famous name. His name is on the front of hotels and other buildings. It's also on other kinds of goods. Well, now the organization that safeguards his operations, DTTM Operations, it's the company that manages Donald Trump's intellectual holdings, has put copyrights on Trump 250 for use on all kinds of things: tote bags, drinkware, sporting apparel, other goods. And another one includes a design of five aircraft followed by converging contrails with Trump 250 imprinted at the bottom. Now, is that a president trying to profit off the country's 250th birthday? Is it a guy whose name has always been his most valuable property trying to safeguard to make sure that everybody else doesn't go out and profit off Trump 250 during the 250th anniversary of the founding of the United States? You can find the question at Lars Larson Show on X and also on our website at LarsLarson.com, and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. But let me get back to Marie Glusenkamp Perez, now running for re-election to allegedly represent the 3rd U.S. Congressional District in Washington State. I played you that piece from one of the ads after she'd already been chosen for Congress once, and she's still portraying herself wearing a Grease Monkeys kind of jumpsuit and saying that she's an auto shop owner. The piece immediately points out that even on the business's own website, she and her husband owned an auto repair shop, that she worked, according to her, mostly behind the scenes, making spreadsheets and burning cookies for our holiday gift boxes. So she wasn't exactly out there throwing a wrench around or pounding dents out of cars. But that's the kind of image she's tried to portray. In fact, it goes all the way back to her time at Reed College. Now, Reed College, I have to say, having known people who've gone to Reed, is a weird place. It's also a very expensive place to go to school. And back when Marie Perez was going to school at Reed, the tuition was $39,000 a year. And yet somehow she managed to go for 7 years, some of it part-time. She said she was paying for her credits, just a few credits at a time. But Daddy had been paying most of the bill, which is, I guess, how you explain spending almost $40,000 a year. Over 7 years, that would be hundreds of thousands of dollars. And yet she ended up with no student loans at all. And she said, well, I worked in a cell phone case factory. Now, if you're immediately imagining one of those places in China that has a sweatshop making all those little cases for cell phones that are sold in America for 10 or 20 bucks or more than that, no, that's not where she was working. She was working at a company called Grove, which made custom bamboo cases for cell phones, and they made them by hand. In fact, one of the pictures shows Marie Perez hand sanding one of these cases. And if you say, well, that sounds like it's awfully expensive, especially when it's made of bamboo, I checked Grove's website. If you wanted to buy one of their desks, just an ordinary stand-up desk where you could set a laptop computer, they'd set you back about $3,200 if it gives you an idea. One of those artisanal jobs that people in Oregon and the Northwest tend to have. She says, I worked three jobs and paid for Reed by the credit hour, working as a nanny, a barista, and an iPhone case factory. That's what she told Reed Magazine just 3 years ago. I did piecework. I worked in a factory that made iPhone cases. Well, the factory was actually in somebody's house, and it included about 10 employees. It was a little teeny startup that was started up by some of her friends from Reed College. But that's the kind of impression that Marie Glusenkamp-Perez gives. She says that at one point, Daddy had cut her off and was no longer paying for school because she wouldn't go to church. Now, she doesn't further explain, is she an atheist now? Does she not believe in God? Whatever it is. Well, apparently Daddy, well, got over it, because even after she graduated from Reed, after taking 7 years to get through school, she had no student loans at all, no debt, apparently. Dad had paid for most of it, and then Daddy helped her buy her first house. And during that time, this story in the Observer actually says that she took a few months off to bicycle from Portland, Oregon, down to Quito, Ecuador, a trip that usually takes 3 to 6 months. So even though she was having to work her fingers to the bone in that iPhone case factory, she apparently had time to take off for things like bicycle trips to Ecuador and things like that, 3 to 6 months. In any case, it would be nice if a member of Congress is going to come out and tell people about her background, if she'd be a little bit on the honest side. She didn't work as the, you know, poor child of a working class family. She worked for a family that could afford Reed College, and apparently today she hasn't stopped lying, or at least exaggerating her background. Glad to be with you on a Wednesday. Always glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
If you don't want to talk but want to be heard, email Lars at talk@LarsLarson.com. He actually will read it. Now, here's Lars Larson.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to- to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead, fish wrapper, or mainstream media bias.
One of the most familiar billionaire names here in the Pacific Northwest is packing up and moving his family thousands of miles away. Howard Schultz took over a tiny Seattle coffee shop and grew it to more than 40,000 Starbucks worldwide. Well, Schultz and his wife have lived in the Northwest for decades, and by their own testimony, they love it in the Northwest. Well, this morning on LinkedIn, they announced they're leaving. And the reason? The unrelenting greed of the government. Both Oregon and Washington have state budgets that grew more than 100% in the last decade. Now, I don't know about you, but my paycheck ain't growing 10% a year. So, did the state government decide to limit its own spending and maybe make life easier for the citizens they allegedly serve? Perish the thought. Washington has a massive new millionaires tax, it's almost passed, that comes on the heels of the biggest tax hike in Washington history last year, or 2 years ago, and with the government warning that by next year, they'll be short of cash again. So, Howard and Sherry Schultz of Starbucks are decamping for a Miami penthouse that cost, according to the Wall Street Journal, $44 million for one place to live. Now, if that sounds like a lot, it most certainly is. But without even knowing Howard's finances, I'll bet that moving out of the new Evergreen State tax hell likely saves the Schultz family at least that much money, probably a whole lot more. My question for you, when Governors Kotek and Ferguson tax all the billionaires and the millionaires out of the Pacific Northwest, who do you think they're coming for next? Glad to get your calls in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. Send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our question of the day, brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery. Get better fast at Multnomah Medical Clinic. CNN actually had a host who went out and said that the ISIS-inspired terrorist attack on Saturday outside Gracie Mansion, the home of the new communist Muslim mayor of Manhattan, that the attack was about, well, that it was against Mayor Mamdani. It was not against Mayor Mamdani. I mean, they've now had two CNN hosts who've repeated the same lie. Let me spell it out for you this way. New York City has a brand new mayor, a communist and a Muslim. And he is the mayor of New York City. There was a protest outside of his home protesting against New York being taken over by Muslims. There were counter protesters as well who disagreed with that point of view. And two of them are now criminally accused of throwing two bombs at the anti-Mamdani protesters. Not at Mamdani, against the protesters protesting Mamdani. But hey, don't let that hold CNN back from lying to people. I'm sure that within the next couple of weeks, both my producer Joel and I agree, you're going to hear people saying, well, don't you know about that bomb they threw at Mamdani? I heard it on CNN. Yeah, my favorite post on X today from Right Angle News. KISS co-founder Gene Simmons says it's time for celebrities like Ben Stiller and Mark Ruffalo to shut the blank up. People work hard for a living, says Simmons, and they don't want to be lectured by people who live in mansions and drive Rolls Royces. It's time to shut up. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
I want to give today's Daily Grill to U.S. District Judge David Estudillo. Estudillo, the judge, has ruled against three different journalists. We know them well. They are Jonathan Cho, Ari Hoffman, one of my colleagues on our Seattle station, and, of course, Brandy Cruz. They all wanted to get the credentials to be able to cover the Washington legislature. One house agreed. The other house said, no, we are banning you from the building. Well, they went to court, and they argued that their due process rights and First Amendment rights were being violated. The judge disagreed and said, nope, the House has a substantial interest in ensuring reporters it permits to access the House floor to meet credential standards. Do you think the founders of this country and the folks who wrote the First Amendment intended for the government to say which journalists could cover the legislature and which could not? I don't think so. I think that's why they wrote the First Amendment. Our best email of the day, but you can send more to talk at LarsLarson.com, comes from Mike Obie, listening on KPNW in Springfield. Lars, I talked to a cousin who lives in Montana, a little north of Great Falls. I told him about Initiative Petition 28. He is a multi-generational farmer and asked if that initiative passes, what do people think they'll eat? I told him they must think everybody will become a vegan. He said vegans have no idea what a complete bloodbath massacre it is on birds and rodents when a combine goes through a field of cereal grain or soybeans, cutting hay as well. Rodents often have a difficult time running out past the edge of the cutting bar in time, so eliminate the hay and grass seed industries as well. IP 28 would affect a whole lot more than just livestock farming. Signed, Mike Obie. To your calls, let me start with Bill in Seattle, listening on, as I said, KVI, our affiliate station there. Bill, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Lars, yeah, I'm just kind of a bit encouraged, like cautiously optimistic. I've read the social media post that to the effect that Senator John Cornyn has changed his mind about the talking filibuster, and he's endorsing a passage of the Save America Act.
Good.
I'm pretty sure that Trump's reluctant endorsement of him, you know, and kind of like a pact on leading on him kind of made the effect. But also it seems like next week, don't quote me on that, but it seems like John Thune is going to bring the Save America Act to a vote with the caveat that he's not going to reform the filibuster, but at least everybody, whether it's a Democrat or Republican who opposes it, speak to the record in front of C-SPAN and all the TV cameras and social media influencers.
Yep.
And we can campaign against them.
And so by the way, Bill, you know what they're going to have to do in a talking filibuster? That means you stand up, you start talking, and when you sit down, then they can take the vote. So if you stand up and start talking and you need to go to the restroom, you better hold it because you've got to keep on talking. That's what they're going to have to do. They've always done it symbolically up till now. I want them to either do a talking filibuster or blow the filibuster up already. We have majority support in both houses for the SAVE Act. We have an American president who's willing to sign the SAVE Act. We have to save American elections. And just look at what all the Democrats are saying. They're saying, you can't kick all those people off the voter rolls who aren't citizens. That's how desperate the Democrats are right now.
The Lars Larson Show. Podcasts, local and national news. Get it all at LarsLarson.com. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a Wednesday. It's a pleasure to be with you. And I want to tell you about this because it's not getting a lot of coverage outside of W Week and maybe on this show because we've mentioned the issue before. A tech takeover of an Oregon health plan led to denied care, billing chaos, and delayed treatment. Should Silicon Valley be running your health care? Aaron Mesh joins me now, managing editor at WWeek.com. Aaron, is that's essentially the story, isn't it?
It's the story of a Providence. It is the sense of the story, yes. So Providence Health Plan, which covers 125,000 Oregonians with health insurance, moved many of its core functions over to a company called Collective Health, which is based in the Bay Area and uses artificial intelligence to handle claims processing. Perhaps predictably, it has not gone very well. People who had long-standing in-network care suddenly found themselves classified as out-of-network. So care was denied and delayed after that. There were member ID numbers altered. There were hours-long wait times to get answers to questions. For providers, payments came only after delays, if at all.
Now, how do we explain that? Because we're told with great confidence, I'm very suspicious of AI, but we're told, oh, AI is going to be faster, cheaper, it'll be better than human beings, it won't have all those flaws that human beings have, and yet it sounds like it's delivering exactly the opposite.
Well, it seems like part of the problem, and to be honest with you, like, part of it is that no one is 100% sure what the problem was. They just know that there was a problem. But it looks like part of the problem was just, like, taking all of the information that was previously in a fragmented system that Providence had, and then moving it over to a new system that recategorized everything, which meant that, like, you know, if you've been organizing your books by the Dewey Decimal System and then you decide suddenly to organize them by the color of the spines, you're going to find that nothing is where it used to be, which is fine, I guess, if you're dealing with a home library, but it becomes a real problem if you're dealing with somebody's health care.
Yeah, it does. And why did they do this? Let me guess, the dollar is what's pushing this decision.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, like you and I get on the phone probably every 2 or 3 weeks at this point and talk about various ways in which healthcare delivery for Oregonians is fundamentally changing and flawed. And I think that the underlying context to that story that we're talking about is that the huge losses that every health system, whether it's on the insurance side or the actual hospital and clinic side, is taking. For example, Providence Health Plan was $102 million in the red last year. It's the worst figure in a 7-year run of being in the red. Its members are using its services at a higher rate. Drug costs have come up. Reimbursement is lower. These are all the factors that every health insurer is dealing with. It's the reason why so many people are frustrated at the denials they're receiving. And again, that context is why there's a desire by these large companies to look to tech companies to save them by automating much of their work. The problem, of course, with automation is that it has a terrible bedside manner.
Well, and not only that, but Aaron, how many of these cases involve healthcare institutions or systems, you know, like Providence system, that are now hooked to the health insurers who appear to be making gigantic profits while telling us that they're going broke providing care? Does that make sense?
It doesn't. And again, we talked about this, I think, literally last week, that so much of this consolidation, so much of these companies buying companies and small clinics closing because they were purchased 6 or 7 or 12 at a time by larger companies, is because of the way in which the tail is wagging the dog when it comes to insurance and healthcare. The insurers are owning the healthcare companies, and the result is a bottom line driven system. Yeah.
Well, and Aaron, one of the things, the mysteries for me, health insurance has never been more expensive. I mean, if you're earning it through your work, your boss is paying perhaps the majority of the cost, but it's tens of thousands of dollars. And even speaking as an old guy, I mean, I don't go to the doctor much. I've got a couple of very inexpensive prescriptions. So, in other words, the Larson family is putting in tens of thousands of dollars. I think the number might be close to $30,000 a year, and taking out, I don't know, $1,000, a couple of $1,000 worth of actual services. So, and you have lots and lots of people. The majority of people are relatively healthy, and it's the people who are getting the care. You'd think if you're collecting gigantic premiums from a gigantic number of people and providing care to a smaller number of people who are actually very, very sick, that you'd be able to make that pencil with no problem. What am I missing?
I don't know. I mean, I will tell you that, like, we're moving into territory now that well, I think it's fascinating that I don't feel like I have an expertise in, right? Like, I am not a person who has spent a lot of time studying. I will tell you that, like, Andrew Schwartz, who wrote this story, has been digging into this really hard for us over the past 2 months. And the more he digs, the more it smells rotten to me.
Yeah. So, and then the question is, how much is the government capable of straightening this out? Because they're the only entity big enough to tell these guys to do business differently. And yet, when I think about Oregon's history with, Obamacare and $300 million Obamacare websites that don't work from day one and things like that, I don't have any confidence the government can straighten this out either. And I don't think the health insurance companies that are making gigantic profits, I don't think they're going to straighten it out either.
Well, I mean, plus the government, both the government and the insurers have a perverse incentive here, right? So the insurers have a bottom line incentive that may or may not match patient welfare. And the government has a perverse incentive because those frequent flyers or high users are almost always, disproportionately on Medicare and Medicaid rolls, which the government needs to have taken care of by these insurers. So they have a need to play ball.
See, and I think at some point this suggests, and I hate to say it, Aaron, but it does intersect there. We got to get about 20 million illegal aliens who are freeloading on the entire system out. I would think that would at least make some difference because we know they're freeloading on the system. And I think that's a big part of the problem. 20 million illegals times, I don't know, even a few thousand dollars worth of health care is going to make a big difference. You can read the whole story at WWeek.com. The managing editor at Willamette Week is Aaron Mesh. Aaron, it's always a pleasure. Glad to get your calls on this Wednesday at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. I'll get to your calls in a moment. And the leaders of the city of Portland say the city needs more housing, but we're now at a 15-year low in issuance of new housing permits, and there's a reason for it. I'll tell you about it next. You and I...
surrounded by Northwest liberals.
I cannot stand these morons any longer. If you don't come with me this instant, I shall run amok.
Come to the place where common sense prevails, the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday, live on the Radio Northwest Network, which has always served the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. This segment of the show is brought to you by 540training.com, concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense. Find them online at 540training.com. There's a story about housing in Oregon that I've got to get to in a moment, but first, I want to go to your calls. Let's start with Eddie. Eddie, you heard my comments about Gene Simmons, and I think he's right on target. What's on your mind today?
Yeah, Lars, I love your show. I listen to you every day at work.
Thank you.
And I love Donald Trump and everything he does. But back in November of 2021, I think Gene Simmons should heed his own advice and not say... because of his fame and fortune, not tell people what to do. Because if you remember, he said, if you're willing to walk amongst us unvaccinated, you are the enemy.
So, and you're right about that. He was, and I think he was dead wrong at the time, and he's still wrong today.
He sure is. And, you know, I used to be a big Kiss fan. I never have seen him in concert, but, you know, they have him and Paul Stanley have a rock and bruise up at A&A, and I will not set foot in that place. Because he felt like that he had the right to tell my fellow Americans what they should do and shouldn't do. And last time I knew, this was a free country. So
that's a very good point. And actually, how well have all those mandates actually aged over the last 5 years? I mean, at the time, there were people saying, well, we have to have the mandates. Well, Joe Biden tried to ram it down people's throats using OSHA and the courts and everything else, and he failed. Donald Trump, I think, to his credit, said, look, the vaccination's there. If you want to take it, take it. If you don't want to take it, don't take it. I think that was the right advice from the government, was say, we're not going to tell you what to do. Unfortunately, you and I both live in the Northwest, where both Oregon and Washington, the Democrats at least, are ready to do it again if they think the circumstances merit it. I would have thought they'd have learned their lesson the first time. Don't tell people what to do. Don't kick people out of the military because they won't take the jab. Don't fire people from critical jobs in Oregon and Washington because they won't take the jab. And yet, I think there's a bunch of them that did not learn their lessons. Eddie, thanks for listening and thanks for the call. Let's go to Chris. Hey, Chris, what's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, I love your show, and because I call frequently, I don't want to just say that and pass over it, because I really, really appreciate your voice and what you do. Sometimes you seem like the only other sane person in the world, and I really, really love the way you vet the issues. And for someone like myself who often considers running for public office, the way you vet the issues and the way you kind of work things through, especially with the naysayers, I think is really, really very important for our region.
What a nice compliment. But my next question would be, why don't you run?
Well, so that leads me to
my No, I want to encourage you. I'm not being sarcastic. I'm saying run for school board. I mean, that would be a great place to get a bunch of conservatives to help straighten out the way we spend money because, you know, the state of Oregon spends a massive amount of money, so does Washington, and they get crap results. I mean, wouldn't you say, hey, why don't I get on the school board and we'll straighten that out?
That leads me to why I actually called. You talked
about
Lynn Peterson yesterday, and you know that she resigned yesterday. So Metro President is now a ship without a helms person, and she's going over to the city of Lake Oswego effective Friday. So that position is open, and I actually filed my candidacy yesterday for the Metro Council President, and I intend to win the primary in May. So I am running in May for Metro President. I think it's an important position for our region. And it's funny because there were only two candidates on Friday. And the way that position works, it's a nonpartisan position. So you don't file as a Republican or a Democrat. I'm actually a non-affiliated voter for reasons I won't go into. But so if you get more than 50% of the voting in the primary, you win, and then there's no runoff in November. But now there were two on Friday, there were three on Monday, and now there's five candidates total, and
wow.
I am one of them. So I intend to run and win for Metro Council President. I intend to bring, show up at the meetings first and foremost, every single meeting, and I intend to bring fiscal responsibility to that very, very important regional position and to work on affordable housing and regional parks and all the things that make our region a great place to live.
Okay, Chris. I you want me to be honest with you, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. I want you to win, but I want your first job to do to Metro what Donald Trump intends to do to the Federal Department of Education, and that is put it out of business. Because I'd ask you, and I don't want you to damage your candidacy, but tell me this, what purpose does the Metro regional government serve?
Yeah, absolutely. There's redundancy there with the other county governments. There's no doubt about it. And I agree with you that I would be willing to look at a feasibility study of outsourcing a lot of what Metro does, if not completely abolish it. There are 1,600 employees there, so it's going to be difficult. But I'm coming in as an outsider, and I'm willing to look
at that. Thank you for that, because Chris, look, I remember Metro as a government when it was three little rooms above the bookstore at Portland State University. Now, that's not just to say I'm old. I'm saying they were a government in search of something to do. And most of what they did early on was complete failure. They said, we'll site a new landfill. They couldn't. We'll site a garbage burner, which they should have, and they didn't. We'll straighten out Johnson Creek, and they didn't. And when you ask them, well, what do you guys do? We run the zoo. What do? You do payroll for the zoo. The zoo was already an operating institution. They said, well, we do planning. And you say, hold on. The state of Oregon has planning. It has legislated, mandated, statewide comprehensive land use planning. Counties do planning. Cities do planning. What the heck does Metro add to that whole mix? And I think they are just a giant nothing that chews up lots and lots of money.
Right. The things that they do, as he said, they run the zoo, they run the expo center, they run the convention center, and they run the arts center, all which could be done independently with independent oversight. I completely agree with you. So those are some of the things we're going to look at. Right now, that institution is a mess, especially with the recent abdication of
yes.
the president, who's going to just abandon role 9
hey, Chris,
months early.
Chris, so, make part of your campaign to talk about Mary Nolan. Mary Nolan is a member of the Metro Council. She's been doing her job half the year from Spain by showing up occasionally
right.
on video calls. And you say, you're paying somebody $70,000 a year to sit on a council with, by the way, with benefits, and she enhances her PERS pension by doing this. And she's checking in, and she's on vacation 6 months out of the year in Spain. I mean,
exactly.
Is it really that worthless a government? But, Chris, good luck to you. I'll be glad to talk to you. And if you got elected to the Metro Council and then said, my first order of business is to put this whole place out of business, I think you'd win. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
FM News 101 KXL is Portland's number one source for news and information. KXL FM, Portland, Vancouver, Salem.
This is CBS News on the Hour, your home for original reporting.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. Suspected Iranian drones hit at least three ships in and around the Strait of Hormuz overnight, continuing attacks that have paralyzed traffic through the vital shipping lane, despite a stern warning from President Trump. The president says U.S. forces have hit 28 Iranian mine-laying ships as of today.
We took out just about all of their mine ships in one night. We're up to boat number 60. I didn't realize they had that big a navy. I would say it was big and ineffective.
CBS's MTS Tayyab in Doha.
It is a very, very dangerous situation that's unfolding in the Strait of Hormuz right now. We have to remember that this is a choke point where 20% of the world's crude oil passes through, and that has ground to a halt. And so the U.S. is concerned, the Gulf is concerned, the world is concerned as this continues.
The International Energy Agency says it will release a record 400 million barrels of oil to ease the hit to the energy markets. Stryker, a global medical tech company, says it is experiencing a global network disruption to its Microsoft environment as a result of a cyber attack. A group of Iran-linked hackers is claiming responsibility. The Pentagon reportedly shut out some photographers at the last two Pentagon briefings. CBS's Cammy McCormick.
Video cameras are still being allowed, but some still photographers have been excluded. The Washington Post reports the move came after Secretary Pete Hegseth's staff deemed some of their photos unflattering. Since then, the paper says only the Defense Department's staff photographers have been permitted into the briefings.
This afternoon and evening, numerous tornado watches have been issued from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, down to Houston, Texas. Damage is being surveyed from Pontiac, Illinois, some 80 miles east to Lake Village, Indiana, where two people died in a suspected tornado last night. It's where Stephen Travis has lost his home.
Walked in a bedroom, got knocked down, climbed in a closet, and it's over. Come back out, crawl out, the roof's gone, everything. So, you know, trees are down, windows are blown out.
A new payphone in Boston connects college students with seniors in Nevada.
The graphics on the bright yellow phone on Commonwealth Avenue read, "Call a Boomer." It connects to a similar phone at a senior living complex in Reno. Calla Kessler is with the group Matter Neuroscience, which set up the phones to connect boomers and zoomers.
They're two of the loneliest demographics.
Kira made a call.
I love it. I mean, I think younger people and older people, I would argue, need to talk to each other more.
We're often in our little bubbles, and we have a lot to learn from each other, despite our differences.
Michael Wallace, CBS News.
Inflation ticked up last month, and the stocks closed mixed. This is CBS News.
The stars shine brighter on CBS Morning.
This is a slam dunk.
So cute.
Y'all came in singing for me today.
On CBS Morning.
Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back. Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I want to bring something up that seems like it should be an easy call. But, you know, the Democrats, they seem so in love with killing babies, even babies that have been born, that they're not even willing to debate something as simple as the Born Alive Act. And before I bring on Senator Dianne Linthicum, who represents Oregon Senate District 28, I want to mention this. If you go back and look at Barack Hussein Obama's history, before he became a U.S. senator, before he was elected president of the United States, he was a state senator in Illinois. And one of the issues that came up that he became infamous for was to stand up on the floor of the state Senate and oppose the idea of requiring doctors to provide life-saving care if a baby in the middle of an abortion was born alive, unintended, but born alive. Should the doctors provide the same kind of care that they would provide any other newborn? And Senator Obama in Illinois said, no, you cannot ask that doctors do that. Well, in Oregon, they don't even want to have the discussion. And at that point, Senator Linthicum joins me now. Senator, good to have you back on the program. Would you mind telling my audience how very simple House Bill 4087 was?
Sure. Actually, my bill is a Senate bill, so it's SB 1554. So we had companion bills on both sides, but I'll just be referencing my SB 1554, same bill. Very simple, non-controversial bill, you would think. It was basically in the hope that we could all agree in the legislature that all living children are worthy of the dignity and respect due to any other living person. So what we wanted to do was ensure full legal rights for all infants, whether you're, you know, born accidentally, quote unquote, via abortion, but you are alive, that you are worthy of medical treatment, because right now they are left to die on the stainless steel table.
Senator, I think a lot of people don't even know that ugly truth. Because it doesn't happen all that often, but when there's an abortion, which is less and less a physical procedure and more they do it with chemicals and drugs, that's about 60% of the abortions. But in the other ones that are physical abortions done by a doctor, if the baby is born alive, they put the baby in a bassinet, put the bassinet in another room, and basically walk away and ignore it for a few hours until the baby dies. And when you describe that to people, they say, that can't possibly be happening in America, can it? Well, what would your answer to them be?
It absolutely does. This bill was brought, I gave courtesy that morning just to bring the issue to the forefront on the legislative floor to a lady here in Oregon, a local Oregonian, who survived an abortion. Now, of course, she's got some disabilities, but she now uses her story to speak for others who were not as lucky, who survive and actually get, I think, some medical treatment. I think her mother, her birth mother intervened. She was adopted. And that's, you know, that's another part of that story, which is really phenomenal. But she brought this idea, to Oregon Right to Life. And, so together we partnered bringing this to the floor where it's just, in concert with the 2002 Federal Born Alive Infants Protection Act, which established that an infant born alive at any stage of development, regardless of whether the birth was natural or due to an abortion, is considered a person, a human being, a child, an individual under federal law. So the act that we brought to the Senate and on the House as well was ensured full legal rights for such infants, because Oregon has been silent and still is, of course, on the standard of care, which must follow. Because even right now, if an infant needs emergency life-saving care with a hospital, if it's like born accidentally at home, there's no requirement for that as well. You're not required to take that baby to the hospital for care. So it's quite barbaric. It's hard for people to wrap their heads around, but that's the story that we have in Oregon, and I'm pretty certain in most blue states.
Senator Linthicum, I want you to make it clear to my audience, all you wanted was you wanted at least to be able to debate it and hear both sides debated on the floor of the legislature on this idea. If a baby is born, even if the intention was to abort that child, if the baby is born alive, that is a person under Oregon law. Oregon law says a person is a human being who has been born. This baby's been born. You have to treat the baby, and you have a duty of care. And they said, we won't even have the discussion?
Correct. So, which is pretty consistent with a lot of Republican bills where they don't even, you know, they just in the waste can in the committee, as your longtime listeners will remember hearing that from the legislators. So we have a procedural legislative procedure that we can, that's called a bill poll, and any bill that is just languishing in committee and not allowed a hearing or a debate, we can pull to the floor and then talk about that bill. And then that also forces a vote. You would then have to vote that you want to pull this bill to the floor and why you don't want to pull it. Like, no, I don't think infants are worthy of protection, or, you know, that kind of thing. So we, of course, had the conversation that infants are worthy of protection and medical care, and that's all this bill does. It doesn't pass judgments on mothers or physicians or anything. No penalization, no criminalization. It just says, please provide medical care to infants born alive.
And they refuse, and you can imagine why. Because, Senator, there are lots of things I stand up for that are unpopular, and that's okay. But I'm also ready to defend my position on them and say, this is why I'm in favor of that, or that this is why I'm against that. The Democrats say, we want to stand up for abortion, even though this isn't abortion, per se. And they say, but we don't even want to have that public discussion, because then we'd have to say, there's no reason to provide medical care to a baby who happens to have been born alive, and it's easier just put them in a basket, set them in another room, they'll stop crying soon enough, and then it'll all be over. They don't want to say that out loud, do they?
They don't, although they voted no. It was a straight party line vote, I'm sure, on the House as well. So they all voted no, and basically they were saying, we don't believe that infants are worthy of protection if the mother was trying to abort the child, trying to take that child's life and not give it life. And you know, on the flip side, there was HB 4127, which they passed unanimously for Democrats, no Republicans, that was going to fund Planned Parenthood in the, if they get defunded by the feds, then Oregon's going to step in and make sure that those services are provided. So, you know, they definitely have an agenda, and it is not life, and it's not protection of children and infants, and that's something that people have to take to the bank.
It's not even life, even when the baby is no longer a baby in utero. It's a baby who's been born, mm-hmm. which means that under the state law, they are now a human. Sadly, Oregon law says that you can only commit a crime against a person, and a person is a human being who's been born. That is Senator Dianne Linthicum. She represents Oregon Senate District 28. Senator, thanks very much. Back in a moment, we'll get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Something to say? Give Lars a call at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. If you happen to be a naysayer, and we love naysayers on this show, just tell my producer what you disagree with me about, and we'll be glad to have a great conversation, let you make your point, as long as I can ask you a couple of questions about why we disagree. You know, when you call customer service, you might end up talking to somebody who's not even on this continent. They might be on the other side of the planet, and oftentimes you can tell that based on, number one, their knowledge of the English language and whether or not they can speak it, and of course their accent as well, which makes customer service a little bit difficult. Should customers or should companies be forced to keep their call centers in America? I want to dig into that in just a moment, but I want to take this call first from George. Hey, George, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today?
Hi there, Lars. I think Wyoming just passed a law that said that you can't have an abortion once the baby has a heartbeat in the womb. The problem is that everybody who's a human being that's alive today passed through a stage where there were a baby in the womb that was alive that did not have a heartbeat. So I don't think that just because you don't have a heartbeat and you're in the womb is a good reason to have an abortion.
No, I agree with you there, but George, it is a start. And that is the heartbeat, it's called the Human Heartbeat Act. It was passed, it was actually passed some time ago, but it was signed by the governor, Mark Gordon, about 2 days ago. And what it says is most abortions are banned once cardiac activity is detected, and that's typically around 6 weeks. It's a very soft prohibition on abortion because most abortions have already happened at 6 weeks. Now, I've seen plenty of people in my business, reporters and anchors, both male and female, who've said, well, you know, at 6 weeks, most women don't even know that they're pregnant. I can put the BS meter to that one right away, because way back when we were debating this because of the Dobbs case, because in Mississippi they had passed a law saying you can't have an abortion after 15 weeks. That's a very broad limit. And you had all these reporters and anchorettes who'd go on the air and say, well, you know, most women don't know they're pregnant at 6 weeks. So I checked with the CDC, you know, the Centers for Disease Control, and I looked because they keep statistics on it. They say that by 8 weeks, two-thirds of all the abortions that are going to happen have already happened. Now, it's tougher to get numbers for exactly 6 weeks, but it's roughly half the abortions have already happened in 6 weeks. But at least Wyoming has got a start on it, saying once a heartbeat is detected, you can't abort that baby, which I think is a good thing to do.
If you're pregnant, you're pregnant whether you realize it or not. So it doesn't matter whether the baby has a heartbeat or whether the mother knows she's pregnant. She's pregnant once the...
And George, I agree with you. And if you could get what, say, Idaho has, which is effectively banning abortion, I'm completely in favor of that. But is it worthwhile for Wyoming to say we can't get an outright ban like some states have, but we're willing to say nothing after 6 weeks? Because you and I think we both understand why, you know, we philosophically believe there's already life there. You can't kill that life. I agree with you. Getting that past a legislature is difficult. Some states have done it. Some states have not. But if you can't get all the law or a majority of lawmakers to agree on a limitation at 0 weeks and zero heartbeat, is it better at least to say nothing past 6 weeks?
It's a good start. But if you do the brain work, you realize it's not enough.
No, I completely agree with you. But, George, there are actually liberals out there who would tell you, well, it's not a baby until it's been born. You say, really? So when you congratulate a woman, you say, oh, it looks like you're going to have a baby. And she says, yes, I am. Do you refer to it as a baby or say, hey, there's something growing inside of you. I understand that one of these days it'll actually be a child. You know, that would be the most bizarre conversation you've ever had, and you probably wouldn't get invited back for dinner the next time. George, thanks for the call. I want to bring this up because the FCC, the same agency that regulates what happens on the radio stations I'm on, the FCC is now looking at rules in which they want to bring call centers back to the United States and improve customer service. Now, I'm completely in favor of that, although I hate telling private companies what they have to do. But I would ask you this. When I saw this story and I thought, well, how do I look at that? I have had, like I'm sure you have had, some terrible experiences where you're talking to somebody where clearly English is not their first language. That's problem number one. Problem number two, their accent is so thick, they have a tough time understanding you, and you have a tough time understanding them. And yet you're calling them to get customer service. Maybe it's help with a credit card account. Maybe it's help with a piece of technology that you're trying to figure out. And what a lot of the companies have done is they've said, we're going to put these customer service telecom jobs, we're going to put them not here in the United States, we're going to put them in some far-flung country, and we're going to teach people how to speak English, we're going to try to educate them to make sure they understand how to solve your technical problems. This is the cost differential, and I'd never seen these numbers before. In the United States, the average cost of a customer service representative is more than $1,200 per week. Now, I imagine that only includes salary. You've got to include benefits and vacation and everything else. It's basically about $5,000 a month to have a person sit and answer the phone and take care of people's customer service issues. Do you know what it costs in the Philippines? $93 a week. And in India, it's even cheaper. It's about $55 a week. Now, I'm sure the companies want to make money, and I'm sure they would rather avoid a $5,000 a month expense in favor of, say, a $200 a month expense for every single customer service person. 70% of U.S. companies outsource at least one of their departments. Many corporations have now shifted their customer service and call center operations overseas. And now we've got the potential that they're going to put AI in charge of it, meaning that when you call for customer service and you say, I don't want that phone tree, I want to talk to a real human being, you may end up actually talking to an artificial intelligence, which means the jobs are going to go away altogether. That's one issue. Issue number two, will that AI actually be capable of understanding what it is you're asking for? And if companies want to do good customer service, those companies should have to do the service using American workers and not using foreign workers who are cheaper, but not always better. Glad to be with you and always glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Agree with Lars? Great. Naysayers go first at 866-HEY-LARS. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, Iran is now threatening to not allow ships to go through the Strait of Hormuz, saying that could drive oil to $200 a barrel. I thought if there's anybody who knows the background on that, it is the author of Born Lucky and the man who writes every day war notes at News Nation. And that is Leland Vitter, host of On Balance and chief Washington anchor at News Nation. Leland, welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you, as always.
So what do you think is going to happen? Because I understand that yesterday the United States, the White House announced that we had knocked out 16 of their mine-laying ships because apparently Iran was going to throw mines into the Strait of Hormuz and stop oil traffic, much of which benefits Iran and our friendly folks over in Chinese communist China as well.
Well, it also benefits Russia because the price of oil keeps going up. If I could predict what was going to happen in the Middle East, I'd also be buying lottery tickets because I think God is the only one who knows. But what we're seeing here is a situation where Trump needs to back up what he has said. 4 years in the Middle East taught me a lot. Lesson number one, tough talk must be backed up by tough actions. And yesterday, he was saying there was going to be military consequences at a level never seen before if the Iranians close the Strait of Hormuz, which is what they're doing right now. You've got to back that up. 16 mine-laying ships to the Iranians is a rounding error. They've been planning for this since 1979, and somehow the Pentagon and everybody else seems to be missing that. And I am perplexed as to why the escalation matrix is not significantly more robust than it appears to be right now.
Do you think there's a reason? Is it that we're clearly capable of a more robust hit on Iran right now? But is there something going on in the, as George Bush would have called it, the strategery that's telling Trump play it this direction instead of lowering the boom on Iran, which he's been threatening to do for a while?
I don't know, but as you point out, he's been threatening to do it for a while. And Iran has flipped two birds at the President of the United States. And when you do that, there has to be consequences. If not, you end up like Obama with his red line. And
oh my, isn't it much worse? Come on, Leland, I was going to bring up Obama, but that was a guy who drew red lines and did absolutely nothing when Syria went past the red line. I mean, that was pathetic.
I was there, and it was pathetic. But for the Iranians, who all they have to do is stay alive, right? They just have to stay alive longer than Donald Trump can tolerate high gas prices. That's their calculus. And to that extent, it is very hard to defeat people who don't fear death. So you have to have an asymmetric, a disproportional response, right? And that is something the U.S. has been loath to do. Now, it could be that they understand that there is more unease, more anger on the streets in Iran than we sense, and that there is some kind of uprising coming. That could be why they are holding back a little bit. I don't quite understand it. The other thing that is very hard to do is to project power from the air. You can do it, but it is very hard to beat a ground-based enemy from the air. hard. You can't occupy ground from the air.
Nope.
And that's effectively what they're trying to do if they want to try to control 50 miles in from a coastline that's hundreds of miles long to reopen the strait.
How about something that disables Karg Island, which is where Iran sends 90% of its oil through this little island 16 miles off their coast, and then it gets loaded on the ships, but do it in such a way you disable their oil off or onloading system, but you don't do it catastrophically so that whenever people come in to pick up the pieces and run Iran, that you can put the thing back in operation relatively quickly.
Well, that sounds like an awesome job for SEAL Team 6.
I agree.
But again, now we go back to, and I'm going to be ridiculously academic here, but Clausewitz, right? War is politics by other means.
Yep.
And there is a political component to this that is not working out the way the president thought it would or his advisors thought it would. Now, much of that's their fault, but they're having to recalculate on the fly. They thought this would be a rally around the flag moment, and instead it's kind of been this, at best, a what are we doing again? Why are we doing it? What's the objective? Even his own party is asking those questions.
Yeah, and it's a reasonable question to ask. Well, what if the people on the ground, according to the polling I've seen before all the attacks started, 80%, maybe even as high as 90% of the Iranian public wants their government to be changed to something that maybe not an American-style republic, but something other than what they've had for the last 50 years. What's the likelihood that any of that is going to happen, given that the country has been significantly, diminished?
All great questions. And there was a significant thought within the Israeli intelligence community and the American intelligence community that there would be some kind of uprising inside Iran. And I think there was also a feeling that there was parts of, more importantly, there were parts of the military that would defect. And what we've learned is that the Iranians, I don't want to say outsmarted us, but certainly planned for this contingency and pushed command and control of the military down to the provincial level, so that individual provinces that were run by hardliners could launch drones on their own, could set their own target sets, could attack freighters in the Strait of Hormuz. So the United States and Israel didn't have to just take out the mullahs, right, in Tehran and the Ayatollah. They now have to take out 31 separate command structures of Ayatollahs.
And are they going to be able to do that? Do they have the intelligence to be able to knock those out and not have one decapitation, but 40 of them?
Well, I wouldn't bet against the Israelis in this. That said, that takes a lot of time. And it's one thing to have penetrated Tehran, as the Israelis did with human intelligence, penetrating 31 separate provinces whose generals don't necessarily travel and whose kids don't necessarily live outside of Iran is a lot harder.
Yeah, it sure is. Hey, Leland, congratulations on the success of Born Lucky. And I am a regular reader of War Notes, and I tell my audience that they can sign up for War Notes free of charge and get your insights into things. Thanks so much for the time.
WarNotes.com. Thanks, Lars.
Very good. That is Leland Vittert, the chief Washington anchor for News Nation, also the host of On Balance. Back in a moment, I'll get to your phone calls and emails. You're not going to believe some of the crazy stuff that Chuck Schumer, Democrat in the U.S. Senate, has been saying lately. We'll get to that next, too. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Between groceries.
Lars reads every email. No, really. Talk at LarsLarson.com. That's talk at LarsLarson.com. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and it's going to be a real pleasure to see Donald Trump tighten the screws. Yes, Iran is something he has to deal with. But the most important thing in terms of saving America's form of government is to pass the SAVE Act. President Trump clearly feels strongly about that. He's told the United States Senate, I want this thing passed. It's already passed the House twice. It is hung up in the Senate, and you've got John Thune in the Senate saying, I'm sorry, we just don't have the votes. We can't get it done. You know, this kind of pathetic BS from Rhino Republicans has just about had me up to here with the Republicans. And why? Because you have majority support of the American people. The polling all shows that a majority of every single demographic group out there, maybe not Democrats, but white Americans, black Americans, Latino Americans, they all want the SAVE Act passed. And why? Because it does three very simple things. I mean, don't let anybody make it more complicated for you. It is three simple things. Number one. If you're going to vote, you have to prove you're a citizen, which proves you're eligible to vote. Now, that's just pure common sense. Number two, if you're a citizen, you still need to provide picture ID to be able to cast a vote in an American election. And then number three, your ballot has to arrive by close of business on election day, not a week or 10 days later, like we've seen in some recent elections. So what do you have the Democrats doing? While the Republicans are explaining why they can't get the job done. And frankly, I really have had it up to here with the Republicans, because every time they're out of power, they say, well, if you would just give us a majority in the House, we could get some things done. You've got that now. If you just give us a majority in the Senate, we'll get something done. You've got that now. If you just give us an American Republican president who will actually sign these new laws, we will get something done. You have all three of those. Get something done. Meanwhile, we have Democrats who are so anxious to hang on to the illegal votes of illegal aliens, non-citizens, and other people who shouldn't be voting in American elections. And I know that some of you have pushed back hard when I've said, look, we've got a huge number of people voting in American elections who are not eligible to vote in American elections. And you say, well, Lars, how are you going to prove that? I'll tell you what, I want to play a soundbite for you from Senator Chuck Schumer. He is a member of the Democrat Party, and the Democrats, I don't think, have been this desperate since Lincoln took their slaves away the mid-1850s. So take a listen to Chuck Schumer about why he feels it's so important to make sure that the SAVE Act does not become law.
It's about voter registration. It makes it, it allows ICE to kick tens of billions of people off the rolls, and they don't tell them until election day, and you show up and you say, you're not registered anymore. You're not registered here. You're not on the rolls.
Now, I got to tell you, number one, Chuck Schumer is wrong. He may have been writing laws for decades on Capitol Hill, but ICE doesn't kick anybody off the voter rolls. Who does kick them off the voter rolls? Well, that would be state secretaries of state. And if you've been voting illegally as a foreign national, and they've caught a certain number of those recently, it means the federal DOJ can go after you. But does ICE have anything to do with taking off the voter rolls? That is just a big fat lie from Schumer. But when he says, we're going to have millions of people who are going to be kicked off the voter rolls, the only way to kick somebody off the voter rolls is if you say, number one, you're not a citizen, so you're not allowed to be registered to vote. Or number two, you are in the United States legally, you're not an illegal alien, but you're still not allowed to vote until and unless you become a citizen. And yet Chuck Schumer admits that millions of people would be kicked off the voter rolls. And when he talks about not knowing that you're not on the voter rolls, again, that is a job for the state secretary of state. In all 50 states, 58 if you're an Obama voter, in all 50 states, you have a secretary of state who oversees elections. Now, if the federal government comes to you and says, hey, we've got a list of people that we just kicked out of the country because they're illegal aliens, and we want you to take them off the voter rolls, you would think that most secretaries of state would say, well, I want to do that. I don't want people on the voter rolls who are not citizens, who are not supposed to be voting. So at that point, that secretary of state is perfectly free to send a notice to every one of those people and say, by the way, we just heard from the DOJ that you're not a citizen. And yet here you are registered to vote. So we're going to tell you right now, if there's been a mistake, if somehow you are entitled to vote, then go ahead and come back down, show us proof that you're an American citizen under the SAVE Act, and then we'll put you back on the voter rolls. Chuck Schumer is just talking plain nonsense, but at least he admits one important thing. Take a listen to the soundbite. Again, Joel, if you wouldn't mind playing that again.
It's about voter registration. It makes it allows ICE to kick tens of billions of people off the rolls, and they don't tell them until election day, and you show up and you say, you're not registered anymore. You're not registered here. You're not on the rolls.
Well, if you're kicked off the rolls, again, ICE does not do this. ICE might advise secretaries of state, by the way, you got a bunch of illegal aliens on your voter rolls. And we all know that over the last 3 years, we've seen a number of states who've identified either hundreds or thousands of illegal aliens and non-citizens who are listed as registered voters. Some of the states, California's had to kick off more than a million people off their voter rolls. Why? Because they are either dead, they don't exist, they've moved, or they're not legally in the United States. And they kicked off more than a million people in LA County alone. State of Oregon found thousands of people who are foreign nationals, and they were scrubbed from the rolls. And then you know what they promptly did? They said, we're not going to look for any more. You say, well, why not? Well, we'll find them as time goes by. This is the level of desperation of the Democrats. They know they have to have those illegal votes to be able to win this coming November. And they are desperate to hang on to them to the point where Chuck Schumer is willing to admit tens of millions of people will be kicked off the voter rolls. Well, as I said, the only reason for you to be on the rolls is if you're an American citizen and have the right to vote in an election. If you don't have a right to vote in an election, you should be kicked off the voter rolls. Now, I would ask any naysayer who wants to call the show, is there any good reason to keep people registered to vote in America and receiving a ballot or able to vote who are not citizens of the United States? I'd be willing to bet there's no naysayer who even wants to take that on. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. I'm a big fan of private enterprise, and I especially like it when somebody has an idea and they start a business and they're able to be successful. And then I'm especially dismayed when I see that the folks in government who ought to be encouraging that kind of entrepreneurism actually go out and try to shut it down. So I received a communication from Key Lee, who is part of a food cart pod in Tigard. And I wanted to find out what the story was. Miss Lee, welcome to the program. How are you?
Good. How are you, Lars?
I'm doing very
well. On your show.
I'm glad to do it, but would you mind describing to my audience, you opened up a food cart pod in Tigard, and it was going very, very well. You're open for a year. I assume you're making money. And what happened then? The city came in and shut you down?
Well, I don't really know what happened. I was working within the application that they had, got started, got the permit and everything that that they required. And then this was 2023, September, we got started, started getting the food carts in February of 2024. Yeah, and then September, I contacted them. We were going to have our grand opening, worked with all the planners. One of them even came out and was, so happy about what we were going to do for the community. working with minorities and, you know, getting them started. And then I go into the meeting thinking that they're going to help me out. And all of a sudden, before she sits down, the economic development person, the person who's supposed to be helping me out, says I'm not compliant because I have, instead of the three carts that they made a law in, what, May of 2024? So instead of three carts, I had two waiting for health license, and she threatened to not give them any health licenses unless I signed a new application that would only restrict me to five versus the 20 I was permitted for.
Now, you got the permits from the city of Tigard to have a 20-cart food pod. So you were approved for 20,
yes.
And then they come in and they put the screws to you and say, look, we're not even going to license the ones you've got unless you reduce it from 20 to 5. Why did they want the reduction?
Well, you know, at first, it's the economic development person. So I'm like, well, she's not even authorized to even do this. So I'm thinking, okay, she's new to the job, and she made a mistake. Her boss was awesome. Lloyd Purdy was amazing. But he quit, I guess, sometime in May of 2024. So I'm like, okay, you know, mistakes have been made. You know, let's go talk to somebody you should know. And then 2 days later, I get an email and said, like I said, they told me that I have to reduce my carts to five. And, you know, they were doing me a favor. I talked to then I had a meeting with the Sambo Kirkman, who is the community director. So these are two heads of the departments. She comes in and she's even worse than the first one. And so I'm sitting there with the four of them, and she's like, oh, you got a violation for this, and you got a violation for that. I'm like, no, I don't. And then so for 4 months, I'm pleading with them, look, you know, I'm losing my cart, guys. I can't, you know, I can't sustain them with only a couple carts. Food cart pods, if you probably everybody in Portland knows, they really kind of survive with having multiple selections, and that's, you know, they kind of work together. So three carts really wouldn't have done it. Five would have been tough, and I was going into the winter. And luckily, I let them go. For 4 months, they put me in limbo, said there's no applications available. Then they secretly put together a ordinance that required not only food cart pods, but food carts that go through a type 2 process, which most people don't understand.
Now, what is a type 2 process, Kai, or Key?
So food carts are generally vehicles. So they're in every other city, they are considered temporary use. They're not building anything, but a type 2 makes you go through the whole process, neighborhood notices, you have to go through ODOT, you have to do all these things with the city. And it could take up to 120 days for them to give you a permit. And that's with food carts. Not only did they do that, they added a $13,500 per cart that I'd have to pay for every cart that I want to put there, which, again, I was already open and I was already permitted. And then they put an emergency on the enactment so that we couldn't even appeal it.
Now, hold on. Key, I want to ask you something critical, and that is,
sure.
They told you in writing you can have 20 carts in this food cart pod, right?
Yes. So there was an application from 2017 to May 2024. So I was working under that application, and yes, they did.
So you spent 7 years trying to get this together. You've got it in writing. They're going to let you have 20. And then they come in and want to change the entire thing. What do you think really happened here? Do they say, oh, we made a mistake, we gave him permission for 20, and they said, we got to figure a way to whittle him back to 5, even though that's going to be economic death for your operation?
Sorry, Lars. No, I was open for a year. And that's why this gets really weird, because, it's an economic development person. She's supposed to be helping businesses, but she definitely isn't authorized to be threatening people. And then you have the head of the city's community development who runs all the planning. And so she's the one that put the ordinance together. We get in front of the I didn't even know. I just happened to get lucky enough to be there that night. During the community time where you can just kind of talk.
Yep.
They didn't even know they were going to do the ordinance. They did the ordinance, and then that's when I found out about all of this. So your question was at first
why are they really trying to shut you down, Key? Do you have any idea what's this all about?
I don't, Lars, I don't know. You know, you got people in the council. They're smart people. They know what's going on. You got two heads of department. They're pressuring me. They got to know that that's not legal. And so I've only deducted potentially two things. And I think most likely it's somebody pretty powerful, because anytime anybody goes over there, they disappear, they ghost me. But it must be something to do with the restaurants, because Ms. Kirkman has said multiple times food carts aren't fair to the restaurants, which I don't understand that. And they kept on saying, you know, that it's similar to a In-N-Out burger, that, you know, they need to really kind of check things out. But we're not an In-N-Out burger. We're vehicles, temporary use. So
well,
I don't know.
And I guess, Key, it sounds to me like they say, I mean, because you could say, well, fast food restaurants aren't fair competition to sit down white tablecloth restaurants. So what? It's not for the government to decide what's fair. It's the government to set the rules. You follow the rules. You looked at the application. You did the application. You got the city to sign off. I'm going to offer Tiger the opportunity to come on and respond. Do I think they're going to return my phone calls? I don't. Key Lee from the Baller Park Food Cart Pod that's apparently being put out of business by the Eco Devo people.
Missed the Lars Larson Show? Get the podcast right now at LarsLarson.com. Now, more with Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. You know, airport security went entirely federal after the 9/11-2001 terrorist attacks. And I remember the discussion we had at the time. There were folks saying, well, we're obviously going to have to tighten up airport security. And the thing I anticipated at the time, and it came to be, unfortunately, as I said, please don't create a gigantic federal bureaucracy. Well, they did anyway. I mean, I don't have that much sway on it, but they said, we're going to create the TSA, Transportation Security Administration. They now have 65,000 people who do airport security at most, but not all American airports. Well, what's happened now? What do we have? We have TSA that's been hamstrung because the Democrats on Capitol Hill have decided they're going to attack ICE, even though ICE is well-funded, by attacking the funding of the TSA and jamming up American airports deliberately. I hope that this November, that when you vote, you will remember that if you got caught in one of these 3 or 4 hour lines at the airport, and they say, well, the reason you're in a line and the reason it's going so slowly is that the Democrats decided not to fund TSA. Because you might then ask the question, well, why do the Democrats not want to fund airport security? And if the answer comes back, and it is the honest answer, well, they decided that if they attacked airport security, that somehow that would shut down an already well-funded agency called Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which, by the way, got full funding from the One Big Beautiful Bill passed last summer, which means the ICE funding is absolutely secure. So the Democrats have decided that while we're in the middle of a war, and you've got the FBI warning California to be aware, and this just came out today, saying to California, you could have some Iranian drone strikes in California. And I know, I probably had the same reaction you did. Isn't there a giant ocean and thousands of miles between Iran and California? And the answer is yes, but the problem is that for 4 years during President Otto Penn, they opened up the borders, they let everybody in, and you had an awful lot of fighting-age males from various countries, including communist China, including Russia, including Vietnam, and likely including the Middle East, who just flooded into America. And we don't know where some of those people are right now. And it's entirely possible that some of them were sleeper cell agents, and perhaps some of them are from Iran. So consider that during all that, the Democrats have decided that the time to send a message by shutting down the funding of the Department of Homeland Security and airport security that they want to do this in the middle of this kind of situation, even though it doesn't affect ICE at all. So why did America ever allow the government to do airport security? Because if they had gone private, and I was one of those back in the days after 9/11 who said, why don't we hire private companies to do airport security? I had a number of people say to me, well, Lars, that's crazy. Private companies couldn't do that. Well, there were private companies doing it already at the airports. And if you said, well, but Lars, government agencies like TSA, they're far more efficient than the private sector. After you finish laughing, you might point out to those people that even today, there are 22 airports in the United States that use private contractors to conduct security screening instead of TSA. Now, you'd be right if you said, well, many of those airports are the smaller airports. Although, when it comes to airport security, does it really matter whether the airport is a small airport with airplanes taking off from it or a big airport? And then I'd give you San Francisco International Airport. It is often ranked as having some of the best security in America. And you know what? San Francisco International does not use TSA. They use a private security company. And in fact, I think the reason for that, going all the way back to 9/11, 2001, is that that is Nancy Pelosi's favorite airport. In other words, a member of Congress and at one point Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, would fly in and out of San Francisco International Airport. And they got very good service from a private contractor who does the security there. Well, TSA was created anyway. Now they have a unionized workforce of 65,000 people. And you can't go a week without seeing a story about one big screw-up or another where TSA has missed something and something got on an airplane that wasn't supposed to be on an airplane. And my answer to that has always been, if you had used private companies, and even private companies that had to compete with each other, I mean, if airport security were supplied by, say, half a dozen different private companies, you could tell all those private companies, and this was the argument I made in late September and early October of 2001. I said, when a private company is hired to do security, whether they're hired to do it at the airport or at a private building or a high-tech company, if the company decides this security company is not doing a good job, you know what you can do with the private companies that are vendors that provide security for the government? You can fire them. And when you fire them, you can hire somebody who does the job better. And in fact, you could have, and this was my argument, I recall making it in late September and early October. I said, you could tell all these companies, we're going to test how you're doing the job. We're going to test how many people you use, how much it costs, how effective you are in keeping contraband and bad actors off airplanes. That's supposed to be the purpose of TSA. And when you find out that they're not doing a very good job, you can say, you know what? We're going to take away some of your airport contracts and give them to this other company that's doing a much better job. And if every company knows we have to compete, we have to do a great job. If we don't do a great job, we're going to lose some or all of our government contract. That would be a powerful motivator. How do you do the same thing with TSA? You have 65,000 people who are government employees. And I guarantee you, the vast majority of them are diligent people who do their job and do it well. The problem is when you have bad actors, you know, folks who go in and they just decide, well, I'm getting paid by TSA. It doesn't matter if I do a good job or not. There are some of those. Can you get rid of them? It is famously hard to get rid of bad government employees. We all know that because we've all run into bad government employees in the bureaucracy or even at the airport. So how do you deal with that? Well, you're going to have to deal with a massive union that represents 65,000 people. If you had private companies doing it, it wouldn't be as big an issue. And as I said, there are 22 airports in the United States that already use private security instead of TSA. And one of them is one of America's major airports, San Francisco International. And they are routinely ranked as one of the best airport security situations in America. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
Portland.
Have something to say but don't want to talk? Email Lars at talk@larslarson.com. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday. Always glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. And naysayers always go to the head of the line. Don't have any right now, but we get them almost every single day of the week. And during an election year, I anticipate even more naysayers. God bless them in their confusion. This segment of the show is brought to you by Oregon Medical Centers, the regenerative medical specialists at Oregon Medical Centers. And our X poll today, should a sitting president be able to profit off his country's 250th birthday? This has to do with Donald Trump, who has now trademarked a number of trademark or copyright issues, including Trump 250 for use on various kinds of goods, as well as another one that says Trump 250 at the bottom, five aircraft followed by converging contrails. The Trump Organization, not Donald Trump himself, has filed a series of trademark applications connecting the president to the nation's 250th anniversary. Well, he will be the president during the 250th anniversary, so there you go. Go to Dan. Hey, Dan, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. Thanks for taking my call. I've been in the electrical industry here in Clark County for 36 years. 28 of those years I've been an electrical contractor. And what I've discovered over the last 3 years or so is when we had Jay Inslee, wonderful Jay Inslee, in office, the electrical, the state electrical inspectors cover the whole state of Washington. And every electrical permit that's purchased goes into this fund. And I've heard this little birdie has told me many times that there's been millions of dollars that's been collected for these, and every July they do an increase, and the increases keep getting more and more, and Inslee would just drain the account, and then he would just start all over. God knows what he did with the money. But here, I just did some research and found out that...
So hold on, Dan. So I understand. The money isn't going to the county that supplies the people who actually go out and do the inspections. Is that right?
Well, no, it's the state. It's not county. County's the building, you know, and that's each. The state does strictly electrical. And if it's an incorporated area like the city of Vancouver, that's got its own electrical inspection, a whole different entity. But the state covers a huge area, and there's a lot of revenue that comes in, but I just got off the phone with the Department of Labor and Industries, the Vancouver office, and they're down to two people in there, which means they had to kind of close the doors because they couldn't man all the, you know, the traffic. So
they're still charging you the same amount or more, but they're supplying less service. Sounds like government all day long, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's, you know, you got two people trying to man an office that's, we're supposed to have eight people in there, and there's only two. But there's two out six, so there's four, right? There's four that they're understaffed, but they're increasing these. And not to mention the electrical inspectors, they've actually doing virtual inspections. So I can get on my phone and do an inspection over the phone and show pictures, and they'll say, yeah, point me to this or that or whatever. But they're sitting at a desk, so they don't have vehicles on the road. They're not burning fuel. And it's like, what? They say that it's a rising operation cost. How?
The only thing I can think of is that Olympia is using it as a cash cow, the same way that the state of Oregon uses things as a cash cow. And it's absolutely wrong. But then again, think who's writing the budgets. I mean, you've got, I was just complaining today that you've got Olympia and Oregon, or, you know, Salem and Olympia, who are constantly saying we're out of money, so we have to have a record-sized tax increase. And as soon as they pass it, they say, by the way, next year we'll be out of money again. And you wonder where it's all going. If they had, yeah. And I kind of wish, you know what I wish states would do? Years ago, there was a great idea that the city of Portland did. I don't think they do it anymore. And they called it an enterprise fund. And they used it for water and sewer. And they said, you are allowed to charge the water and sewer users as much as you want, but every last dime of it has to be spent on supplying water and sewer service. So in other words, you can't use it as a cash cow. And they got caught a couple of times and sued for tens of millions of dollars, and they lost when they tried to divert some of that money. I mean, and if you had that kind of arrangement at the state level, You said Fish and Wildlife, you know, has to maintain itself on the fees paid by hunters and fishermen. You know, and inspections has to be paid for by the, you know, the folks who want the inspections, you. And it, all the money, though, has to go to that purpose. And if you can find a more efficient way to do it, frankly, Dan, I was impressed. We had a new furnace put in our house about 3 years ago. And the guy doing it said, oh, we got to do an inspection. I said, okay, when's the guy coming? He said, he's not. We're doing it, you know, like you do, like you just described. And I said, well, I want to watch how this works. So the inspector calls on a, you know, Zoom call or whatever on the phone with video. And the guy who's putting in the furnace walks over. He says, I want to see this. I want to see that. I want to see the other thing. He's satisfied that it's all done, you know, correctly. And boom, done. Think how fast that is instead of a guy or gal in a pickup truck driving miles and miles from one inspection to the next one. It makes sense. But in that case, the fees shouldn't have to go up at all. If anything, they might stay flat or even go down, wouldn't they?
I would agree with you 100%. And typically these inspections, I'm on the phone. It takes me longer to get to the Zoom call to where it's ready to do the inspection than it actually takes the inspection. So if you think about the time that they're on the phone is literally 3 or 4 minutes and it's done, and then we hang up. Well, do the math. If I got a permit that cost $125 to $150 and they spent 3 minutes to do an inspection, I wish I could make that kind of money.
Yeah, no, you and me both, because I think that is the direction they ought to be going. And frankly, the other idea I've always liked, Dan, was there was a thing called the Green Light Program. I had a friend and they ran their own trucks and they go pick up recycled metals, you know, non-ferrous metals and stuff like that. And he said, we were on the Green Light Program. I said, how's that work? He said, we run our own scales. We make sure our trucks are running legally down the road. They don't have to stop at the weigh stations. I said, really? They let you do that? And he said, yeah. And then every once in a while, they'll spot check you. And if you're out of line, then you drop out of the Green Light Program until you qualify to get back in. I mean, if you're a plumber and you're putting in water heaters, and how long does it take to inspect that? And you're sending in pictures saying it was all done by the book, et cetera. And you do that. If you're on a Green Light Program, you could say, we're going to check your work from time to time, and there will be harsh consequences if you didn't do the work right. But if you do the work right, and then you send in the pictures, then maybe we don't have to go out and take a look at all. Dan, thanks very much. I appreciate the call. Glad to get your calls and your emails. Send those emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis.
The Lars Larson Show.